Find all sorts of opinions and add your own at RN Online.
Hello, I'm Sarah Kanoski and welcome to Books and Arts and our very first 2016 African Book Club. And the novel that we're beginning this year with is Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's Half of a Yellow Sun. And it's a novel that perfectly embodies really why we wanted to take Africa as our book club theme this year. Firstly, it's a fantastic book. It's a gripping story, beautifully told, with characters you really feel you know and that you really care about. But equally, Adichie's novel opens up a part of the world and a part of history that many of us in Australia are ignorant of, in this case, the Nigerian Civil War of the 1960s. And finally, although it's set in the past, Half of the Yellow Sun is very much a novel of today, written by a woman still only in her 30s, who, yes, won the Orange Prize for Fiction in 2007 with this book, but who's also had her TED Talk on feminism sampled by pop star Beyoncé. So from Beyoncé to Civil War to a bittersweet love story, this novel has it all. I hope you can stay with us on Books and Arts. And joining me for our first African Book Club is Manu Bobo, who's a radio producer at ABC Local, and she's our first-time reader of Half of the Yellow Sun. Manu, welcome to Books and Arts.
Thank you. Hello, Sarah.
And with Manu in Sydney is the novelist, essayist and China specialist Linda Davin. And the reason we have a China specialist on our first African Book Club is because this novel is one of Linda's favourites. Good to meet you, Linda.
Lovely to meet you, Sarah.
And joining us from Bathurst is a Nigerian film academic professor at Charles Sturt University, Chika Anyan. Hi, Chika.
Hi, Sarah.
And Chika's going to just have to keep correcting my pronunciation of all of the Nigerian names in this book as we go along. So that's your special role, Chika.
Oh, thank you, and I'll charge you for that.
Exactly. That's part of how we roll at the ABC. Let's start with the first impressions that you all had of this book and how you came to it. Linda Davin, how and why did you pick up Half of Yellow Sun?
Well, it was a series of coincidences. Somebody had given me Chinua Achebe's Things Fall Apart, and I read that and was very, very intrigued. I realised that I hadn't read any African literature by Africans. I found on my bedside, for some strange reason I still can't explain, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's That Thing Around Your Neck, and I devoured it, and I went, oh my God, because I thought, oh, she's Nigerian, you know, I'll start with her. I was so astonished by her writing, by the power of her writing, by her characterization, everything, that I immediately went and devoured everything she had written, one after the other. I rarely do that. And when I got to Half of a Yellow Sun, I just thought, this is one of the best books I have ever read. I've put it up there on my mental shelf alongside Madame Bovary and a couple of other absolute dead favourites.
Fantastic. Well, Chika Anyan, what about you? How did you first come to the novel?
It was coincidental. Actually, I went to Nigeria for a keynote speech at the University of Nsukka, of Nigeria Nsukka, 2007. And on my way back to Australia, I was at the airport with one of my colleagues who is the editor of the Guardian newspaper. And we were just chatting, and he asked me, have you read this book? I said, what book? And he told me about it. So I went to the bookshop at the airport at Murtala Mohammed, and there it was. So I bought it. That was my air flight back to Australia read. And yeah, so it was incident. And ironically, it was about, I mean, I gave a talk on political leadership in Nigeria, and there was this book talking about the war.
Talking about it, and a lot of the novelists will discuss is set in that university town in Lusaka, so
exactly.
a perfect place to pick it up. What about you, Manu Bobo? We've asked you to read it for Books and Arts. We love to have a first-time reader of the book. So you've just fresh to the novel. What were your first impressions of this book?
Well, I actually discovered Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie through a TED Talk. So I saw her give a TED Talk about the importance of diversity in narratives, and that sparked my interest in her. And I read Americana, which I loved. And so I've been meaning to read Half of a Yellow Sun for a long time. And my first impressions when I did read it, I actually finished the book last night at 6 p.m. and then I watched the movie. So my first impressions were, whoa, completely different from Americana. I thought that when the way the book began, I did not expect it to end in the way it did. So my very first impressions were, I thought it was amazing, right throughout from the beginning to the end. I thought it was great. I was left a little disappointed at the end, just because, you know, it's a long book. It's almost 700 pages long, and I felt that there was no definitive conclusion at the end. And as a reader, I felt a little bit, I was a little bit angered by it in a way.
Well,
sorry?
Well, we'll have to get to the end in your anger, Manu, but we better start at the beginning before we jump across to that point. And no, I should just say that Americana, which you were mentioning, is the most recent book from Adichie, who now spends her time half in Nigeria and half in the US. And we'd love to hear from you too. We've already had some feedback. Di's texted in saying that she liked the book very much, a successful blend of history and fiction and a powerful anti-war novel, and the war is a crucial part of this book. But we'd love to hear your responses to this novel. You can text us on 0418 226 576. That's 0418 226 576, or tweet us, as you always can, at RN Books and Arts, or there's Facebook, lots of ways to get involved, and we want to really make this a book club conversation between all of you. So for people who aren't familiar with the plot of Half of the Yellow Sun, let's outline that. Linda, how do you describe the plot of this novel? And as Manu said, it's a big book, but what's the overall plot?
The wonderful thing about this book is that it's so complex, and yet it has a very clear plot. You have a situation set up of two sisters, their lovers, a lot of subplots of betrayals and ambition and conflicts and all of this. There's a middle class, upper middle class situation in academia, in business communities in Nigeria, and there's a character called Ugwu, who's a servant, very, very crucial to the whole plot, who comes in from a local village and is the servant of Olana and her professor or revolutionary boyfriend, as her sister rather dismissively calls him. And when the war comes, when war comes to them, the middle class, upper class Nigerians experience the war in a particular way. They're losing their homes, their privilege, and they're confronted with absolute horror, the total and incredible devastating of horror of war. Ugwu's trajectory is quite complex. Ugwu sort of has a much more a varied trajectory. He sort of seems to be going up in the world, down in the world, around the world. These stories are all interwoven. The plot is basically about a group of people who have their world completely upended by war.
Exactly, and it shadows, it sort of moves from character to character, and it does some interesting shifts with chronology as well. So although it's all set in the 1960s, it sort of shuttles back and forth between different periods of that decade. Chika, explain for us the meaning of the title of the book, Half of a Yellow Sun.
Look, Half of the Yellow Sun is actually is a symbol of the Biafran flag during the war. I don't know if any of you have looked at the war, which we'll come to later on, but actually the sun itself, it was almost like a sunset in Biafra, sort of. There are movies about that, but it's actually that orange, which in itself it represents the future, the rising sun, because the Igbos or the Biafrans, we are actually the eastern part of Nigeria, which, if you like, symbolically is the rising sun, the east. And the beginning, and so that's the yellow sun. But also, if you think about the colors, that represents the black, the red, and the green. Which the green, if you start, which is about the future, the growth, the agriculture, and the red, the blood that's shed. And of course, if you think of the the red, the blood I shed, and the black, the people who are the black race. Mm. And so the green is the future. So the sun is the future, which is more like a aspiration. So that's, and so taking the half, the yellow sun, the sun is actually a half sun. That's the symbol of the Biafran flag and also the image of the sun.
So it's the symbol of the flag of Biafra, yes. Which is...
Of the Biafran War.
Of the Biafran War.
Which,
And we should just say, if people have a sense of the African continent in their head, Nigeria is on the west part of Africa, right next to Ghana, where Manu, your mum and dad are from. So we're in that part of Africa. Before we go into looking at some of these characters in the novel in depth, let's hear a bit from the film that was made of this book in 2013. This is part of the trailer of Half of the Yellow Sun.
Happy Independence Day.
Happy Independence.
Thank you.
I just don't get what you see in these English boys.
I applied for a job as a lecturer in the Department of Sociology and I got it.
A special woman is arriving this weekend. Very special.
Yes, sir.
My name is not sir.
Yes, sir.
You should eat first.
You really moved in, haven't you?
My sister's revolutionary lover and his band of drinkers.
Let's get married.
What's happened? There's been a coup.
What's happening in Lagos?
This is the beginning.
You're with Books and Arts on RN. I'm Sarah Kanoski and we're discussing Half of the Yellow Sun, a novel by the Nigerian writer Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, and it's the first in our African Book Club series this year. And with me, I have three passionate readers of this book, Manu Bobo, Linda Javen and Chika Anyan. Manu, as we've said, you're our first-time reader of this novel, and Linda mentioned the character of Uwu, which is where this book begins. What were your impressions of him?
So, at first I disliked Uwu, then I barracked for him.
What did
then
you dislike
I
about him?
I hated him, then I begrudgingly forgave him. There were so many different emotions involved. I mean, I disliked him because in the beginning he was very voyeuristic, a little bit strange. but then he grew on me, even when he did odd things like wanting to use tear gas to get a girl. Because he didn't quite understand, the implications of that.
He's full of romantic longings, full of sexual longings, perhaps more accurately, Uwu.
He sure is.
We should explain that he is the houseboy of this middle-class couple of academics, and he's come in from a village, and the whole world that he's witnessing of this middle-class African life, it's something that is very foreign to him.
Yeah, that's right. So, and we sort of go on a journey with Uwu throughout the novel. And I think the reason towards the end, although he committed an act that, would be unforgivable, the amount of remorse he showed, because we're seeing it from his point of view, this particular incident, and we're seeing a lot of things from his point of view. And I think Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie did very well in bringing certain characters into our consciousness by demonstrating what they were, what their beliefs were, and that sort of thing through point of view.
Mm. Linda, tell me a little bit about the man that Uwu works for, about Odenibo.
Odenibo is the revolutionary professor. He's very nationalistic. He has very strong views on, as is very understandable, about the white colonialists in Africa and the post-colonialists and all of that. He's very proud. He's very smart. And he's also very egalitarian. So he's the one who says in that trailer, that little excerpt from the trailer we just heard, "Don't call me sir." He insists that Uwu calls him by his name, and he introduces Uwu to reading. He's also very passionate. He's And I think what's very interesting about him is that he's a very political person. He's got very, very strong ideas. He has this, he hosts this daily, almost daily salon of friends who come over and argue politics. It's a sort of, I would love to be at his house. I just, oh my God, I love this man. But he also is confronted with what happens when your ideals become reality and when the reality gets upended by more reality. And he's fascinating in that way. Yes. He's got a mother who's very, very superstitious, a kind of a village woman who doesn't understand his world, doesn't like it, doesn't like his choice of woman. And the conflict between him and her. What I'd like to just pull back and say for a moment is that all of these characters have a kind of a symbolic resonance throughout half of Yellow Sun, whether it's the sisters, one representing a kind of an idealism, another a pragmatism, whether it's, Odenabo, the revolutionary, Ugwu, the village boy, or him versus his mother as being, you know, education versus illiterate superstition. At the same time, they're fully fleshed individuals. I don't think this is an incredibly difficult trick to pull off. And as a novelist, I just admire her so much because they're laden with significance and yet they never become ciphers. They're never, ever ciphers.
I think that's very true. And Chika, as Linda's saying, there are these tensions between Odenibo and his mother and the tensions between village life that his mother comes from and that Uwu, the houseboy, comes from and the sort of Western educated, politically savvy middle class that Odenibo belongs to. Does that reflect the kind of Nigeria that you grew up in? Because this, we're reminding, is set in the 1960s, post-independence but pre the Civil War. Does it ring true for your memories of Nigeria?
Yes, exactly. Look, the beauty of this book, and perhaps what attracted me, is the complexity of the narrative itself. I mean, look, Chimamanda actually uses symbols. The names are symbolic. The activities are symbolic. It's not just arbitrary, which is just a creative power and the power of the book itself. I mean, if you look at the names of each of the characters, they mean something. They're not just names for the sake of names. And that's also very symbolic of the Igbos, because names in Igbo mean something. The condition when you were born, the situation of your birth, and that's what she used in creating the characters. So understanding the names of each of the characters actually will tell you the story, and that actually creates the complex, tapestry, which she wove the entire narrative. So, yes, politically, Nigeria post-colonial or pre-colonial is totally different from today's Nigeria. The 60s was the era of the, you know, if you like, the new Nigeria, politically speaking, post-colonization. Prior to that was the agitation for independence, and therefore post-independence, the early part, you have the what you can call the radical Marxist academic movement, political agitation, trying to create the egalitarian society that the elite have actually dreamt and read about. So you see, in fact, Odenibo's house, as you were mentioning, was more like what you can call the public sphere for the intellectuals. It was almost taking a Marxist type of a saloon or tea room type of meeting place where people come to discuss politics. Mm-hmm. And so if you think about the traditional way, unfortunately, and this is part of what you can look at Franz Fanon's work on colonization, that to name is to earn, and to be named is to forget origin. If we think of that word from Franz Fanon and look at the Odenibo's mother, you actually see that the mother is still very traditional. He's been educated, and therefore his ways of thinking, like Ugwu was saying, it seems as if master has been reading too much, and sometimes he thinks too much, because the way he focuses on reading, and he also believes that education is the foundation. That's why he told Ugwu, if you do not read, you cannot know how to move forward. In other words, there is that conflict between the traditional past and the future, and which is where this conflict is resonated within the university, which is where, if you like, the citadel of enlightenment, where the political discourse is fermented and then explained in society. I don't know if that makes sense. Yes.
It does, and I think that's it opens up the fact that this book begins in a very hopeful place, and particularly in that character of Oda Nibo, who is this brilliant maths professor with this circle of politically engaged friends who cross across the three ethnic groups in Nigeria, which we haven't spoken about, but which we'll need to talk about in terms of the war, that these are mainly Igbo people, but they have friends from other tribes, the Yoruba and the Hausa as well. And it's just a place where you think anything is possible. That's really communicated strongly at this early part of the book. We've been focusing on two of the key male characters, on Oda Nibo and the houseboy Uwu, but we need to talk about the sisters, who are really also at the core of this novel. And to lead us into our discussion of the women in the novel, let's hear from Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie herself, as remixed by Beyoncé.
We teach girls to shrink themselves, to make themselves smaller. We say to girls, you can have ambition, but not too much. You should aim to be successful, but not too successful. Otherwise, you will threaten the man. Because I am female, I'm expected to aspire to marriage. I'm expected to make my life choices, always keeping in mind that marriage is the most important. A marriage can be a source of joy and love and mutual support. But why do we teach girls to aspire to marriage and we don't teach boys the same? We raise girls to see each other as competitors, not for jobs or for accomplishments, which I think can be a good thing, but for the attention of men. We teach girls that they cannot be sexual beings in the way that boys are. Feminist, a person who believes in the social, political, and economic equality of the sexes. You wake up.
That is the author of Half of the Yellow Sun, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, and it comes from a TED talk she gave called We Should All Be Feminists in 2013 that went viral and got picked up by Beyoncé and then used in this super hit pop song Flawless. Linda Davin, is this a feminist novel?
Oh, I would say absolutely. And it's a feminist novel in the best sense. It's not a feminist novel that drives the narrative along ideological or dogmatic lines. It's a feminist novel in that the female characters are fully realized. They have their own ambitions. They're smart. They don't define themselves solely by their men. I suppose it would pass, what's that test, the Bechdel test or something?
Yes, that's true. The great test that women have got relationships with one another where they're not just talking about men.
Yes. I would say, yeah. This is, for me, a completely feminist novel, but it's not one that is exclusionary. The great thing about, what to me an ideal feminist novel is a universal novel. And it's a non-feminist novel is one that doesn't take women seriously as fully realized characters. So on that very basic definition, or moves women around according to other agendas, I think this is a great novel, and it does have very strong, admirable, interesting, flawed women characters.
And the two women who are at the core of it are these twins, Olana and Kainini. What was your take on their relation, Manu?
I thought in the beginning they didn't seem that close, and then they faced some, particular adversities that separated them, but then drew closer towards the end. And I found there was really a curve there, like a definite change in their relationship.
Did you like one more than the other, Manu?
I liked them both equally, and that was because they were so different. You couldn't have had twins more different from each other. He had Kanene, who was described as unattractive, but she was very sassy and savvy, and I loved her character. And then there was Olana, who I could relate to because she had a warmth, a type of nature that was quite, quite giving and warm. But then she also suffered, great adversity and responded to that in a particular way. But I thought, you know, there was obviously betrayal.
Well, let's talk about that. But we need to say, I think, that one of the factors of the descriptions of Alana that keeps coming through in this novel is her beauty. You know, everyone's sort of falling in love with her. And that's part meant to be part of the contrast with her twin. Although they're both very independent, very bright, determined characters, there's this sort of physical reality of Alana. And I have to say, if you watch Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie give her TED Talk, you can't help but think Alana must be based on her, because she's a stunning woman. There is obviously, I think, she's had some personal experience of this, is my guess from just looking at her.
Can I say that watching the movie, which I only did this week, I was like, but they're both so beautiful. I couldn't.
I had exactly the same response, Linda.
Is that a strange casting decision, or is that a cultural thing?
Yeah, and it's interesting because, I mean, we've had a text in from Colleen saying that the film version was quite good but a little bit sketchy and pared down. What do the guests think of it? And we'll draw that out, I think, particularly in relation to the depiction of war. But I agree, the casting was, I mean, they're both gorgeous. And the thing that Kainine in the book is quite androgynous. She's described often as very tall and sort of quite masculine, but it was an extremely voluptuous actor who played her on this. So that didn't quite work for me in terms of that distinction. But Chikra, I wanted to ask you about the fact of them being twins, because apparently Adichie has said that in an interview that in Nigeria, birth order is so important that she had to make them twins, otherwise there'd be all this stuff read into which of the sisters was born first.
Yes. Well, if I actually take you a bit back, and the two characters and the two sisters, first of all, their father, and this is an Igbo tradition, usually the male is the preferred. I mean, every rich man wants to have a male child because that's for continuity of the generation. In this novel, we never heard about them having a son or a brother. And therefore, and if you think about the name, the father called Olanna, which means the father's jewel. Now, that in itself has got significance. Now, Kainene, that's Kainene, the sister, means let us watch. Now, and if you think about the two characters, Kainene is the one who is more like the business entrepreneur, taking over the family's business. Now, Olanna, who is the jewel of the father, is the one being prepared for marriage, or more like, if you think about the femme fatale, in a way. So these are two different characters. But if you come back to a twin, let's not even go back to the history of twins in Igbo culture, which used to be a taboo.
Mm.
But the idea of being twins is actually there is an important, if you like, leadership structure in Igbo land and the politics of Igbo land. Age group is very important. That's part of the governance of the Igbo people. So it's not just about a central governance. It's actually about age group, community groups. Therefore, people are paired according to their age groups. So if you are older, then you have a higher responsibility and respect from your junior. So to make these two characters equally important, which is part of the feminist movement of equal participation, equal rights, then they have to be twins. If one had been older, then you would have expected that one to have more respect or more responsibility. And this is the way I looked at the two characters. Therefore, in line with the, in terms of having a male child and a female child, one has to take over the responsibility of the father's business. As you know, Ozobia means, in fact, let's not go into that, but his name also means something in terms of the novel rich, let's get more money, doesn't
mean. Wow. See, it's so clear, Chika, obviously, that you're getting so many different layers of meaning from reading this book than those of us who aren't Nigerian are. And though I do have to say, as the youngest of seven children, I'm really glad that age, the age structure isn't so present in Australian society, because that would be a really bad call for me. This is Books on Arts on ABC RN. I'm Sarah Konoski, and we're having our first African book club of the year. We're discussing Half of a Yellow Sun by the Nigerian writer Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, and my guests are Manu Bobo, who's a writer and radio producer, Linda Javen, the author and novelist, and Chika Anyan, who's a professor of film studies. And we'd love to get your comments about this book too, or particular questions if you want to put them to our guests. Our text line is 0418 226 576. That's 0418 226 576, or you can tweet us at RN Books and Arts, or get on Facebook as well. Now, just before we move to the war, I think that we have to look at the betrayal that happens between these two sisters, because it seems to me that it's a little kind of microcosm of what happens on a much bigger scale in this novel, and that is Oda Nigbo's mother, who we've discussed, is a village woman, very much wants her son to have a son, and she brings in a village girl, a serving girl, and Oda Nigbo sleeps with her. She gets pregnant, and then what happens, Linda?
Well, what happens is very interesting, because the mother doesn't like Olana. She thinks she's a witch because she's educated and she doesn't act like the proper sort of girl, like a village girl who would be obviously under her mother-in-law's control. But what happens most surprisingly is that the girl gives her up and Olana adopts her. And this is a very surprising thing. It brings out an interesting depth in Olana, because she's very, very jealous when she finds out what's happened, and furious. But she adopts Baby, as she's called, for much of the book.
And it's interesting. That's one difference, I think, that's important between the way a film works and the way the book works, in that in the book, because it shuttles back and forth in chronology, we meet Baby and we just assume it's some Olana's natural child. And then we go back in time and hear the kind of complicated story that that led to Baby entering their life, while in the film it just follows the straight chronology. So we get a surprise in the book that we don't get in the film about this aspect of Olana's character and that family dynamic.
Yes, absolutely. And just to add one little Chinese note to the sisters and
please,
the twins.
You've been very restrained so far, Linda.
I know. I thought of them as yin and yang. And I thought that they acted, that they were twins. I completely appreciate what Chica was saying. And I'm like, oh, I was completely wrong. Or maybe all of this comes into the thinking of a novelist, because a lot of it is subconscious. But I thought they were a fantastic duality. You know, they represented two kinds of life philosophies, approaches to the world, personalities, and so on. And as Chica was explaining, Kainene was invested with more of a male role, in a sense. And so they are the yin and the yang, which, of course, in Chinese Taoist philosophy, always are part of the whole, and each has an element of the other within.
Yeah, indeed. And although they do have this rupture in their relationship after, what happens after Olana sort of takes revenge on Oda Nigbo by sleeping with the only important white character in the book, Richard, who is the man that Kainene has been seeing. So when that is revealed, the sisters have a falling out that lasts for quite a long period in this book. There's a lot of anger, a lot of resentment between both of them. But that then gets resolved under the shadow of war. So let's move our conversation about Half of the Yellow Sun into the discussion of the war. And to do that, let's hear first a little more from the trailer from the film of Half of the Yellow Sun.
The only authentic identity for an African is his tribe. I'm a Nigerian because the white man created Nigeria and gave me that identity.
Get out.
It meant nothing. I want you to stay away from my house. Stay away.
Passports! Bring out your passports!
How can I leave my children and run to safety?
You will be fine.
Why are you running? Where are you running to?
Mama, people are fleeing.
It's dangerous.
Don't waste my time!
I feel as if I have been dropped into something that I don't entirely understand.
I was so worried when Port Harcourt fell.
We're at war.
And that comes from the trailer for the 2013 film of Half of the Yellow Sun, and that's the novel we're discussing today on Books and Arts, the first in our African book club. Chika, what happened in 1967? How did this war begin?
The war itself, perhaps, if we go back, there are so many historical documentations of the war. But I suppose if we go back to post-independence, 1960, and then the first census that was taken between 62 and 63, there was that inconclusive result that led to agitation, and there was a lot of uncertainty about who we are as a nation. And if we go back, and this is being factual and honest about it, Nigeria is a complex tapestry of countries that were amalgamated by force through the colonial leadership. And therefore, the idea of independence was like a forcing a fusion of collectivity amongst disparate cultural and linguistic groups. So post-independence, getting a leadership style that will actually get the country together was very difficult. Mm. So when the first coup took place, you discovered there was a problem in 63 when the census issue started. And so Tafa Balewa, who was the first prime minister, was killed by Agui, who was the military administrator, and I mean became the military administrator. And Balewa was from the north, the Hausa, and Agui is from the east. And something also to understand is that during that period also, Nigerian armies and armed were actually concentrated in the north, with little in the south, which is the west and the east. So if you think of the leadership that started from the colonial administration, the northerners who actually had an emirate system of governance was favored by the British, and therefore they were more or less given the authority or the blessing of leading the country. Okay, so that created tension. And the Easterns and the Westerners were more middle class. They had their own different type of communal and monarchic type of leadership, and therefore they were more or less alienated in the whole system. So there was a tension of inequality and unequal distribution. So that was one of the tensions. And so when the Eastern general killed the sitting prime minister, who is a northerner, there was tension in the north. And therefore, the Igbos who were in the north were almost like being killed in retaliation. And so in 66, Irunsi had a counter coup and killed, had a counter coup that he was killed by Gowon. And then, that led to his death, and Gowon took over. And Gowon is also from the Fulani North. And so it escalated until 1967 when Ojukwu then felt that the best needs to secede from Nigeria. And so the war became imminent that it had to take place. And so the Biafrans, those who were in the north, where Easterners moved. And something important is also, unlike Australia, where the state you live becomes your state, in Nigeria, if you are from the east is still your home. Even if you can live most of your life in the north or in the west, you are still a stranger. The same thing if you are a northerner and you live in the east for the rest of your life, you are still a northerner. So there is almost like three countries living in the same place.
And I think that we got a sense of that in that little grab from the film where Odenigbo says, "I'm not Nigerian, I'm Igbo." And this sense that there were these three very disparate tribal groups, different in religion. The North Hausa were Muslim, and the southern groups are Christian or shamanistic beliefs, the Yoruba and the Igbo. And so as part of colonialism, these very different groups are stuck together in this place called Nigeria, kind of invented by the British. And then after the British leave, the ethnic tensions, not surprisingly, break out between these three different groups. And there's this series, as you were describing, Chika, of coups and counter-coups until the eastern part of the country attempts to break free and create its own state, Biafra. And it's that the war that follows that, which was only, I think, around about 3 years, 1967 to 1970. That's the second part of this book, Half of the Yellow Sun, focuses on what that experience of war is and what it does to the characters. And for me, it was certainly a new part of history. It wasn't one that I knew about. I wanted to ask you, Manu, your parents are from Ghana, the neighbouring country of Nigeria. Was this history of Biafra and the Biafran Civil War something you were familiar with before reading the book?
Not at all. I grew up in the Hunter Valley.
it's a long way from Nassau.
A long way. But of course, my parents are very aware of it. I spoke to my dad about it just this morning, and he was saying that Biafran radio at the time was broadcast into Ghana. You know, you could hear some of what was going on from Ghana. And he remembers that period. Me, myself, I was quite confronted by the, like, by how much I didn't know when I read the book, because, it was really quite shocking. And
What are some of the images or some of the descriptions of the violence that then fully breaks out into war in this novel? What were some of the most striking for you?
The most striking included a mother holding the head of her dead child in a bucket, and then talking about how long it took to braid her hair. Now, that was shocking. Mm. There was also a scene where a man gets his head blown off and his body keeps running for a period of time after his head's been blown off. Yeah. These images, to me, were intense. You know, it was shocking.
Yes, and I think because, and we'll come back to you in a moment, Chika, who actually lived as a child through this war, but as outsiders, the fact that we're seeing these horrendous events through the eyes of characters that we've come to know and love, it's kind of like we're put in the place of witness in this novel, and I think there's a lot of power. We feel that the power of those atrocities very intimately, I felt, Linda. Was that your sense of the depiction of war and violence in Adichie's book?
Absolutely. It was so powerful and it was so moving. And two of the things that stand out for me are an image of a wedding, Olana and Odnibo's wedding, which is completely, there's a shelling and horrible things happen. I don't want to ruin it for any other listeners, but it's, who haven't read the book, but one of the things that's always struck me about massacres and about war is that they can happen under beautiful blue skies, that war doesn't happen out there. You know, you can kind of think, oh, war's on a battlefield or this and that, but war happens. It doesn't happen, on schedule. So it just comes straight into this wedding. That's one of the images. The other is Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's incredible mastery of detail, just like Manu was saying, that those images are so indelible. And one of the things that I really loved was, it was a conversation in which somebody was revealing, a friend of Kainene's was revealing how they could tell who was Igbo, even when they were in disguise trying to run away. And this Hausa friend said, boots. You know, we soldiers wear boots all the time. So they examined the feet of each man, and any Igbo man whose feet were clean and uncracked by Harmattan, they took away and shot. They also examined their foreheads for signs of their skin being lighter from wearing a soldier's beret. You know, these are the details, the mechanics of massacre.
Yeah, indeed. I think that's very well put, Linda. I want to hear from you, Tika, who were a child in Nigeria when this war broke out. How did you read the depiction of the Biafran War in Half of the Yellow Sun?
Look, I give the book credit for putting human face to the tragedy of what I can call the theatre of war. As a child, I lost my childhood in a way, and I wasn't alone. A lot of us did. I was 7 when it started, and if the war had taken, if it had lasted more, maybe 6 months, maybe we would have been at the war front. And that's exactly because we're all in, say for instance, as a child, we were going to school in the forest because we got to be very ingenious. In fact, when in Australia, we talk about education in the bush, which is funny, but we actually had to study in the bush, in other words, to avoid the air raids that targeted aluminium, zinc, and any metal, so that any dwelling. So we actually had a more like education in the bush. At the same time, when you finish, you go for training. So the boys' company, which was the next layer to the boys' brigade, onto the war front because there was no other alternative. So that's one thing. So in a way, we lost our childhood as a result, but we grew too quickly. The other thing I saw about the war and the book is that she used the love. And this is where it becomes very interesting. She used the part of love as a way of addressing the issue. think about, if we go back to the beginning, we think about, we talk of Odonigbo's tea room, I call it. It was a convergence of all the people. It doesn't matter which state, tribe. They were all together. They were in love for the same country, for the same ideology. But of course, the war destroyed and created that tension between who is Yoruba, who is Igbo, and who is Hausa. And I can see that even as a student in Nigeria at Ibadan, we were all good friends. In fact, we were the ones who, more or less, you can say, we wanted to have, we're in denial. And that's perhaps the way I think the novel itself sums up Nigerian situation, because the country is still in denial. And therefore, when Kenaine wasn't seen, it's not because she wasn't. It actually happened. A lot of people disappeared. The Afia attack, which is the attack market, was a place almost like a Passover, where you have to go in a hurry before the war, the bombing starts. Buy a few things, run away. Some survived, some didn't. And perhaps that's how Kenaine disappeared.
So for people who haven't read the book, all of the characters are caught up in this warfare, and they have to leave their home, and they're in refugee camps. And Olana actually teaches in a bush school, Chika, like the one that you described, going to yourself as a child. But then these sisters are separated. Kenaine goes to try to trade food across a border and doesn't return, and the final part of the novel is the characters searching for her and looking for her, but the knowledge really that she has been lost to the war. But equally lost is that character of Uwu, who again is squares with your experience, Chika, that he was press ganged as he's still a young teenager into serving as a soldier. And you alluded to this earlier, Manu, is that he, who we've come to see as this very sweet, very gentle, loving character. He spends a lot of time looking after the baby in the book. He's a very gentle person. But through war, he becomes involved in a very vicious rape, a gang rape of soldiers. And I think that illustrates, when we talk about the intimate details this book gives, the lens through war of personality, is his, what happens to him as a character sort of, I think, suggests what happens to the country as a whole, Manu.
Yeah, in a way, it is emblematic. I think that his character arc was really, really quite interesting. And like I said, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie really makes you feel for the characters, because you're there along with them and seeing things through their eyes. And I think with Ugu in particular, because we're with him right from the beginning of the novel, sharing some very intimate moments with him, and then moving into, the gang rape scene, my reaction to that was, oh my goodness, it was so unexpected.
And Chika, I want to hear from you. Just, we've got another grab from Chimamanda Adichie herself about Nigeria, which I'd love to play. But just before that, give us just a sense briefly about how the war is remembered in Nigeria today.
Look, the war is, people are still in denial, put it this way. And that's perhaps the problem that Nigeria faces today. We are still in denial. But I have to put it in cultural context. The Igbo person, for instance, is a warrior. Historically, they are warriors, they are farmers. In fact, I see Chimamanda's book as an extension of Things Fall Apart and No Longer At Ease by Achebe.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's an extension of the post-colonial tragedy that faces Nigeria. But as warriors, they are actually in denial because in the Western society, we think about therapy, psychological therapy, PTSD, we know about here. But during the war, it's called shell shock. And therefore, there was no reparation. Nobody actually, man up, that's the word that people tell you. Get up, you're a man, bear it. So the idea of agreeing that we had a problem was never discussed. There was no reparation after the war. Gowon said, no victor, no vanquished. But when there is an issue that actually addresses or brings up a discussion about the war, it's actually quashed. Mm. The movies itself, in fact, Things Fall Apart was adapted as a film by Francis Oladele, and it was actually stopped because the military then said nothing has fallen apart, and that the novel was almost destroyed in the U.S. under the name Bullfrog in the Sun. The same thing, a lot of Nigerian filmmakers or literary critics have tried, but nobody is old enough or strong enough or has the willpower to believe. What happened in South Africa is a typical example. It's not going to solve the problem, but it opens up for people to know that there was a problem. And this book actually brings up that discomforting conversation to the bear. And that's where I love it, because people need to actually address it, face it, and move forward.
Bring up that dialogue, as you say. So I want to just hear, before we get your concluding remarks, each of you, about why this novel is important and what its legacy is, let's have some final words also from its author, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. And she's talking here from an interview with Ramona Cavall for The Book Show about her ambivalent feelings on Nigeria.
Nigeria is the place that most frustrates me. It's the place where I most complain. You know, every time I'm home, I'm complaining about something. I am, you know, reading newspapers and talking back to the newspaper. I'm getting angry. I'm watching the news and I'm just getting angry. I'm watching the Senate proceedings and I'm getting furious. But it's also home. It's where I meet the most interesting, most ingenious people. You know, it's where I just find that the ways in which people move on, the way in which the people just find ways to continue to live and to laugh and to hold on to their humanity. And to make music. It's also a place that I have a lot of hope for. You know, particularly my generation. You know, I sort of refuse to despair. Or maybe I just despair for a few hours and then I sort of put it aside. And also I think that often in talking about countries like Nigeria, that we forget how young they are relatively. You know, that sort of taking a long view of history, that Nigeria is a baby. It you know, independence in 1960, it's quite young.
Chimamanda Adichie, they're speaking about Nigeria, and she, of course, is the author of Half of a Yellow Sun, which is the book we've been focusing on today in the first of our African Book Club series. Manu Bobo, leave us with your thoughts about this book. How does it matter to you?
This book matters to me in so many ways. I think that African literature is important. I think that diverse voices in literature, as the author has said herself, is very important. And I think that historically, the fact that this is set during the war, and although it's fiction, she's done a lot of research and included things in there that actually happened to real people. I think that educates as well. And I think she used humanity and humour to do that in such a bleak circumstance.
Linda, what about for you? How are you going to hold on to this book?
I agree with everything that Manu has just said, and I would like to add that I hold on to this book as something that not just introduced me to a world, but introduced me to a great writer. That's very important to me. And one of the things, if you look at the way she treats every single character, nobody is patronized. You know, the person who would be easiest to patronize would be Richard, the white lover who wants to be Biafran, essentially. And there are very cringy moments with him, but she doesn't make even him simple. I think she is a fantastic writer, and what it leaves me with is a desire to read everything else she ever writes.
Well, that's a great accolade, and it is, that complexity is a mark of a great novelist. Chika, just the last few moments to you. We've only got 30 seconds.
Oh, great. Well, look, the book itself, I will just take a quote from the conflict between Richard and Kainene when he betrayed her. And he closed his eyes with from Amolia's work. He said, "The unbroken happiness is a ball. It should have its ups and downs." And I believe that Nigeria has got its ups and downs. It never will be perfect. But the most important thing is to move forward, because it's an endowed country. It's one of the richest in the world, and also got the intellectual capacity.
Fantastic.
And therefore, there is hope for the country.
Oh, that is a perfect note to end on. Thank you so much to my guests, Chika Anyan, Manu Bobo, Linda Jivan. And you can hear this conversation again, get all the details at the Books and Arts page on RN Online. I'm Sarah Kanoski. It's been a treat to have our first African Book Club. And get reading for the next one next month. Earshot next on RN.
Well, there's science.
Science.
Music.
Music.
Mayhem and malarkey. Street life.
Bush life.
Food.
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 History.
Philosophy.
Politics.
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 Funny stuff.
And enough's enough.
If you're curious about everything, so are we. RN Afternoons, 2 hours about everything, with me, Michael McKenzie, 1 till 3 weekdays, and online all the time, right here on RN.